just to make sure the staff is a little intimidated by my presence.
I'm James Zug, and this is Outside the Glass. In October 2016, I interviewed Kevin Klipstein, the president and CEO of U.S. Squash. We sat down in a back room off the basketball court at the Daskalakis Athletic Center on the campus of Drexel University. This was during the 2016 United States Open, which we staged at the DAC. We put the interview up soon after. It was episode 11 of a brand new podcast called Outside the Glass. This pod focused on Kevin's journey in squash from childhood, college. We ended it right where a 30-something out west was having a preliminary interview for a job at U.S. Squash. All right, that was episode 11. This is episode 100. It's nearly 8 years later. We again got together on Drexel's campus, this time 100 yards away from the DAC at the Arlen Specter U.S. Squash Center. His office is a part of the national headquarters for U.S. Squash and a part of the world's largest community squash center. Since Kevin and I last talked for OTG, a lot has changed. We went through some of the milestones of his first 20 years helming U.S. Squash, including working for 100 straight days when he started in December 2004. And then we shifted to what will happen between now and the 14th of July, 2028, when squash debuts at the Olympic Games in Los Angeles.
Here we are today with Kevin Klipstein. I'm just Einstein.
That's what you always say.
That's right, Einstein and Frankenstein.
the two big ones.
Just to make sure the staff is a little intimidated by my presence.
He's really smart and he's scary. So, yeah, when we talked for the previous podcast, we talked about your childhood and we sort of got up to when you started working at U.S. Squash, the USSRA back then, and you started in December of 2004.
That's right.
So we're getting your 20th anniversary in a couple months. What was the state of the USSRA when you arrived, and it's a little bit different than it is now?
It's certainly different. Well, we're sitting here in the offices, the national headquarters at the Arlen Specter U.S. Squash Center, which is a 75,000 square foot center on Drexel University's campus, two blocks from the Amtrak 30th Street Station. So 20 years ago, we were in Bala Cynwyd in half of a townhouse, and there were a few staff members, V.J. Chitness and Jeannie Shanahan and Ann Farrell. And there was not a lot of substance to the organization at the time. In fact, when I started, there was a bit of a movement towards wanting the organization to not actually be involved in national championships. So fast forward 20 years, and that's really sort of unimaginable. So when I started, we had to sort of establish ourselves as the owners and operators of these national championships,
right?
Because at the end of the day, that's a big part of what national governing bodies must do is actually ensure the integrity of national championships, obviously select and field national teams. Then ultimately, what most of our work is focused on is the development of grassroots and support of the grassroots and growth of the game.
But that's the pinnacle event. What was the feeling that, all right, the local people will just run whatever event they want, you know, they'll do it whatever standards, and the national organization shouldn't sort of have, you know, poke their nose into that tournament? Was that the theory?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, it's kind of strange to reflect. You know, I'm now sort of the old guy, and I was thinking I played an eighth grader in a tournament this weekend, and he's been playing a couple of years, and he said, well, after we played, he said, oh, you looks like you're not even sweating. I said, look, I've been playing for 43 years. You know, I've got a lot of experience, so don't feel badly. I think within a year or two, you're going to be beating me. So it's interesting in that when you look back into the early 2000s, leading up to that point, the sport had largely been driven by volunteer efforts. Mm-hmm. There were fewer than 10 national championships, and in each case, for the most part, the local association rallied dozens of volunteers to make up what was a great event. And there wasn't the technology to support it. The only people who knew it was happening were the people who were participating. The results may have made it into a newspaper or two. So it was just a very different world then. And in the early 2000s, things started to change. And then within a few years, everyone had a cell phone, and the internet became sort of the backbone of everything that everybody does. And so the fact that I've been in this role almost half as long as I've been playing squash is a little startling to me. Again, when I started, ironically, my first 100 days, I worked 100 days straight, 7 days a week for months on end, because there was no one to run these events, but it was our obligation to make sure they happened. And so it was really a trial by fire on that front. And there's some really great experience in sort of making sure that I had to roll up my sleeves and get it done in every aspect. So it's nice in that I've pretty much done every role in the organization in one way, shape, or form. Obviously, we do it on a scale that's much, much larger than we did back then.
You told me some story about the first weekend that you, I don't know what day you started, but like that upcoming weekend, you were at a tournament or something?
I started December 13th, and the following weekend was the U.S. Junior Open. We had 600 players at Yale and Choate. Vijay Chitnis was in the role of Director of Junior Development, ostensibly.
Yep.
And it was basically he and I and a few volunteers, including Melinda Justy, who we just honored for having established the high school championships 20 years ago. And, yeah, Vijay was running the tournament almost single-handedly. I jumped behind the tournament desk, and I asked him about what was happening over at Choate. He said, "I don't know. Hopefully things are working out." So I'm not sure we even staffed that venue. So it was a different time. I remember that summer, really, Vijay and I were sort of doing everything, and we were talking about all that was happening that summer with the national teams, et cetera, and sort of going through the calendar. He was running down the stairs to catch a flight, and I said, "All right, see you in a few months. You know, good luck. Every man for themselves." And so it was a pretty fast-paced time, but we did establish ourselves as really taking pride in running outstanding national championships and obviously investing heavily in the juniors. And a lot of people, you know, along the way have contributed to where we are now. Connor O'Malley, Bill Buckingham, who's still with us, Dump Wilkins, who just moved on, Rich Wade, Preston Quick, who's still here, Graham Bassett. Just there are dozens and dozens of people who have cycled through the organization and many who have stayed. And some great leaders, too. Jeannie Blasberg took over from Ken Stillman. She was very resolute in wanting a clear strategic plan for the organization. Peter LaSousa, Eric Fast was heavily involved and helped us do our first $1 million-plus fundraising campaign. Mark Pagan helped in every aspect of getting the Spectra Center done. John Fry, people forget, was chair of the organization for 3 years. So there have been some incredible people involved over the last 20 years.
Yeah, you just said that you think maybe 100 employees have cycled through. And so you've been, you know, going from kind of doing it yourself, you know, at the grassroots, answering the phones, going to events, and, you know, bringing the placards and, you know, kind of just doing the actual work, and now sort of managing all these different people and all these different roles. How many employees do we have now?
We have the equivalent of about 33 full-time employees.
Right. So you went from 3 to 33 in a tiny little, you know, 1,000-square-foot house with two parking spaces to this incredible facility. So it's like a pretty interesting transition.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to talk about sort of prospectively looking forward, but some of the milestones that stand out to me, in 2007, we ended up moving the organization to New York.
Right.
We felt like it was more of a crossroads at the time. The financial support was largely coming from New York, and so we moved there, and that lasted about a dozen years. Obviously, we moved the entire association back here when the Spectre Center opened. In 2008, we made the decision to fully fund the junior national team. Previous to that, the juniors made the world championship team, and then they had to go out and fundraise $5,000 or $6,000 to fund themselves to go. And so in making that decision, we sort of started to establish ourselves as the ones ultimately driving the high-performance program.
Mm-hmm.
In 2011, John Fry had joined the board, and we took over the U.S. Open. John Nimick had been operating it to a large extent in the 2000s, and we felt like that would be an important marquee event for us to drive and leverage from a marketing perspective, and Drexel agreed to host that. By 2013, we established the U.S. Open as the first major event to offer parity and prize money for women, with the rest of the tour following pretty shortly after that. And the depth and quality and caliber of women's squash has equaled that or more. And we also started the high-performance program, which in 2013, we knew Todd Harity was graduating, and we had a strong interest in his turning professional. And so we knew we had to have some sort of structure for him in place, some sort of funding.
Right.
And interestingly, I literally just saw him at the center here this morning, which is sort of part of the vision that we're all together and supporting each other and being integrated into everything we do. And we knew Amanda Sovey was going to follow on in 2 years. And then we also integrated Squash Magazine into our operations to build out our communications. So in 2015, we started Club Locker as a brand, built out a court reservation system. The scoring system, which people forget, used to be on a chalkboard in venues or
a clipboard
and manually scoring, and maybe you reported the scores a week or two later.
Right.
So taking that all online was important to us. And by 2018, we had the provisional green light to pursue the Spectre Center project. And that same year, College Squash became its own entity, men's and women's combined, which is something that we really encouraged and supported. And then pandemic and the Spectre Center opened 2021. And then by 2023, last year, included in the LA Olympic Games. So, you know, in every phase, it feels like we've either initiated change to support growth and development or made something happen that served as a catalyst to the next. So, for example, the Spectre Center actually happening and being something we could point to on a grand scale, we think had an important role in our ability to make a convincing pitch to get the sport into the Los Angeles Games.
Yep. Well, and I think, you know, going to prize money parity, that led to the merger of the men's and women's pro tours, which still today no other, you know, sport has that, and how important that's been for the development of men's and women's squash, junior squash globally. That's been a, you know, a key after effect of the parity push. Club Locker is amazing. Like, yeah, I mean, everybody forgets, but you know, you'd walk into a venue, you wouldn't know what the score was, who was beating who, and now everybody with these iPads is, you know, it's all instantaneous, and grandparents who aren't there at the venue can follow what's happening, and everybody is you know, connected and knowing what's happened at the moment rather than, you know, hoping to figure it out later in the week or never. So these things have had these spillover effects that have you know, have helped junior squash, college squash, adult squash. You know, I mean, the experience at a tournament is, or a match, is just radically different now.
Absolutely. Well, you look at the dual matches, and we're proud to have hosted many of the college squash nationals here. Yeah. And you look up at the big Comcast business scoreboards, and you know exactly what's happening point by point, match by match, and what the outcome might be, as opposed to people
sort word of mouth.
Word of mouth, looking left and right, texting each other, what's going on.
Yeah.
It's really transformed the experience, and I think made it a lot more exciting and interesting for everybody. So it's been fun to work in a relatively small organization and sport and see it develop in that way and have a vision for things and then see it come to life. And, you know, that's what we're going to continue to do. We feel like we've done well in terms of collaborating with college squash, with Scholastic Squash, with Squash and Education for the LA Games. We collaborated hand in glove with the World Squash Federation and PSA. That was key to our success there. And just continuing to do that, the theme for us has been we're a relatively small sport, so everybody getting on the same page to drive big initiatives makes the most sense and is the most efficient. And so we're going to keep driving that moving forward.
Well, another effect of the Spectre Center is that community squash is now a real viable part. We were just talking about this, like you have a facility, it's a new way of thinking about it, you know, all about access and, you know, and bringing new people into the game and having them feel welcomed and included. And that's a core part of the organization's vision is access. And the Spectre Center is, you know, doing that here on site, and we're also sort of helping model and push that out to various facilities around the country.
That's right. It's a really interesting inflection point for the sport now, where while it feels like, and people may have the sense that we're making this massive pivot now that we're in the Olympic Games.
Right.
In reality, we've been working towards this ability to really drive growth in the sport the whole time. Having solid technology behind it, it provides the best return on investment and makes us scalable as a small organization. So that's been important to us, to be able to not only support the growth, but be able to drive it. And we're at that point, and now the fact that we're in the Olympic Games creates an opportunity that we haven't seen before for a couple reasons. But one will be, and it will become increasingly clear to everybody in the squash world, as excited as everyone is, that the awareness and the validation of the sport to everybody else outside the squash community is invaluable. And the idea that people know what squash is now, that people understand, oh, you're in the Olympic sports, I am going to take this seriously now, is so valuable, because that's a key part of our growth, is having people, when we're knocking on their doors and say, hey, we're squash, we'd like to talk to you about the sport, say, come on in, let's talk. You know, we understand who you are and what you're doing. And so, and it becomes cyclical, because as demand is driven for the sport, we need people for places for people to play.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to increase the number of courts that are accessible to the public. Scholastic and college squash are a big part of that too, in that the majority of youth sports is done at a scholastic level or at a club level as opposed to an individual level, and that flows through to college opportunities. And then, of course, the more people you have involved in the sport, the bigger your pipeline is for talented kids coming through to be ultimately world champions, which is where we want to be. And so that becomes cyclical. As awareness builds, you get more people, more access, right, et cetera.
Right. So what do you think life looks like for the game in America in the next 4 years, four years and 4 months? Like, and what do you think life looks like, you know, in August of 2028, when it's over and we've all left LA feeling great, and you know, what's the picture that month?
Sure. Well, what we envisioned at that point is dismantling the two or three exhibition glass courts and relocating them into two or three different locations, likely community squash centers that have been built or in the process of being built as a legacy to the games in Los Angeles.
Right.
There's a lot of activity going on there already. SoCal has done a wonderful job of organizing people and building bridges towards the LA Unified School District. Access Youth Academy in San Diego is growing into LA as well as a grassroots move, both in terms of sort of broader community access, but also the squash and education narrow and deep model. So there's a lot of opportunity in LA. It's a huge geography. It's a huge population-wise, but not quite a squash desert, but pretty close to it. So we see a lot of opportunity there. So that's Los Angeles, and we always wanted to work towards investing in LA, and now sort of triple the reason because of the LA Games. But generally, the strategy is continuing to push as we have on increasing the number of middle and high schools, public middle and high schools that have teams. Because of the Olympics, again, we were pushing on this previously, but now we're being taken a lot more seriously by
you felt that way, like you're having conversations and they go, oh, okay, Olympics, yeah, you're a real sport.
They say, we like the idea of our kids playing an Olympic sport,
really,
and having the potential opportunity to be Olympians. It just shows how transcendent the Olympic brand is, and so those conversations are happening now. I mentioned LA, but there are other major cities that are open to it. So we're developing a physical education curriculum where we can go into schools at scale. We're talking about thousands of kids, introducing them to the sport. And ultimately, in the case of Philadelphia, then we can bring many of them. We're already hosting more than a half dozen middle and high school teams from the public schools.
Yep.
We can bring more kids here. But then ultimately, we have to be able to provide viable, low-cost courts that can be co-located to middle and high schools all across the country. And so that's another area of focus of ours, which is creating sort of lower-cost, modular, portable indoor or outdoor courts.
Right.
In the case of LA, likely to be more outdoor. In the Northeast and Midwest, likely indoor in underutilized gymnasiums and things. And so we have to be able to fill those gaps, spark interest within the schools, provide places that are convenient for them to play and accessible, and, of course, be able to provide coaches and program directors as well. So, you know, we've really scaled that program up in terms of our Coach Pass program, internship programs where we're recruiting kids out of college, training them to operate programs so that you can't just put up courts and hope people will play. So it all works together.
Yeah, exactly right. It's about having the courts, but then servicing those courts. You know, right now we have just a couple outdoor courts in America. How many outdoor courts do you think we'll have in 2029? Do you think we'll have, you know, a dozen, or do you think there'll be, you know, that'll become a large part of the, you know, there'll be a couple hundred maybe, and that'll be a normal part of squash is like, oh yeah, we play outdoors.
I think that we'll have hundreds. I think we'll need the community's help and support to make it happen. The job of the governing body, our job, is to lower the barriers for these, to create best practices, to make it as seamless and frictionless as possible, whether that's to be able to access low-cost courts and afford them and know how to put them up, whether it's to start up a middle or high school program.
Right, programming.
And whether it's how to plug into our high-performance program from a local to a regional to a national level. Those kids that are the most motivated and most talented, no matter where they are, how do they come along that journey and get the support that they need, regardless of means and background. So that's our job. It's the lowering the barriers and facilitating best practices. And so that's what we're focused on, the phys ed curriculum, the how to start a middle and high school program, the low-cost courts. We will also be providing direct funding for these things to get it off the ground.
Yep.
But then ultimately, the handoff is to local communities to say, yeah, we're interested in making this happen. We understand the model. We understand the cost. We're going to raise what little money is required. We're going to help sell it into the middle and high schools. We're going to make it happen and create those opportunities. So
yeah.
We're making a lot of progress at our level, and then we'll be met halfway, I believe, by the squash community, because there's a huge appetite for growing the sport, I think.
Yeah.
You know, for the last 20 years, if you ask the community consistently, you know, what do you want to see out there? People want to see more access to the sport. They want to see the sport grow. Well, you know, we're going to be providing those opportunities. And, you know, I think it's also interesting that a lot of the squash and education programs have recognized, acknowledged, and acted on the idea that having their own facilities is important, not only to ensure that their core program participants have access to it, but that they're able to offer squash and community building activities, you know, outside of squash and outside of that core programming. So they really are, in effect, becoming more community squash centers with varied lanes of programming. And, you know, the person who pioneered that thinking really was Barrett Takesian up in Portland Community Squash, but then you have Atlanta Community Squash, and you have Access Youth Academy and others. And, of course, you know, we've done the same thing here at the Spectre Center. So serving as a model, showing how that can work. You have Open Squash in New York City, which effectively is running sort of that hybrid model of it's a nonprofit. Someone's put forward the capital to in order to make
get
the facility
started.
Happen and get started.
Yep.
And then the goal there is to break even and expand. And that's what we're all collectively trying to do. So I gave David Owen a lot of credit for what he's done there. And you know, hopefully we'll partner with him and others to do the same around the country.
Well, and you and I were at the opening of the new facility in Wall Street, and everybody was saying, look, there's a lot of square footage of empty offices around the city, around lower Manhattan, and really around the country. And so that is this real opportunity to help facilitate, you know, leveraging those empty spaces and having squash, not just in Manhattan.
That's right. So at the junior level, we've grown about 3x in the last decade, and the girls more than the boys.
Mm-hmm.
We want to continue to push that through the middle and high school level at the public schools. We are working closely with the College Squash Association to advance their goal of 40-40 by 2030, which means 40 varsity women's, 40 varsity men's teams by 2030. But that also means growing and developing more club programs at colleges, and also more activity just general at the grassroots at these huge facilities.
Well, using these courts, right? A lot of them are kind of empty, and they should be filled.
That's right. So there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of collaboration happening. And then as we lead up to L.A., we will also be focused on either leading or supporting more awareness building made for TV components for squash. Squash TV and the PSA have made real progress in marketing to the squash audience. As squash grows and develops in the U.S., we see sort of really critical need to increase people's awareness of the sport in the U.S. That only makes our jobs easier.
Yeah.
So made-for-TV, more entertainment-focused products are what we're going to advance as a priority. It's interesting to see the NSL, the National Squash League, started by two of our athletes and where that will go. But those types of ideas, seeding those, seeing that how that develops, and seeing how the broadcast of squash evolves relatively quickly leading into the games and then beyond.
Right.
So, you know, we want to make sure, obviously, that we get into the 2032 games in Brisbane, maybe there'll be an India in 2036. That would be, you know, great and sort of create that.
Is that the latest thought that it might go to India?
That's I think that's part of the thinking when cricket was added to LA 28.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. So so yeah, there's a lot's been achieved. We've got a strong foundation.
Yeah.
We see no reason we can't equal or exceed the last decade in terms of driving growth.
Yeah.
And opportunities for people to play as awareness builds and access increases.
How we are sort of one of the more prominent governing bodies in squash globally. You know, you spent a lot of time partnering with international organizations and other national governing bodies reach out and connect. And how has that sort of evolved over the 20 years for you, you know, in terms of U.S. squash and our global, you know, footprint? You can't say anything negative.
It's evolved in the sense that there's a little more respect for squash and American squash on the international stage. Obviously, our top women have performed incredibly, coming in second place in the Worlds recently, a few players in the top 10, and others ascending the ranks. I've been told at the British Junior Open, which is a very prominent junior tournament, that people are still scratching their heads a little bit internationally of like, hey, how are the Americans doing so well?
Right.
So I think there's some awareness of the emergence of squash in the U.S., which is amusing in the sense that there's such a rich and deep history.
Right.
The entire, you know, 20th century of squash in the U.S. was so robust. So, you know, we're in a new era now. I think to a large degree we're leading. But just like anything else, squash, trade, politics, geopolitics, it's complicated. And encouraging collaboration can be difficult. A lot of other countries, actually all other countries, have a different model from a sport development point of view.
Right.
So I think it's sometimes hard for other countries to connect and relate to how we develop the sport here versus how it develops in their countries where, to a large degree, it's, if it's successful, it's because of centralized government funding.
Right.
Whereas, you know, obviously the U.S. is more innovative and entrepreneurially focused.
Yep.
And that's what we've tried to embrace and will continue to.
Well, we have the backbone of high school and college squash, right? You know, I think the statistic is maybe half our facilities are at high schools and colleges.
Nearly,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty close. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a very firm backbone for the game. When there's ups and downs economically, we're able to ride that a little better than other countries that you know, a lot of those facilities are, you know, can end up getting closed because of market conditions.
Well, certainly the collegiate system is the envy of the world. The private schools are a great strength of the sport and the private clubs. And it's important that people also recognize that there's a huge ecosystem outside of those too. So the mix of them is sort of the strength and the fabric, and it's in, you know, the U.S. is so unique in so many ways, and that expands into squash as well. So,
yeah.
And you know, as you see other trends in the world and in the country where you see declining opportunities for youth sports participation, you see more people spending less time who are active. You see people sort of more isolated. You know, the sport really addresses a lot of sort of the ailments that we're encountering this century.
Right.
And we're sort of countercultural in that way, in the sense that our trends are actually all positive. It's nice to see pickleball burst onto the scene. A lot of people are sort of considering playing a racket or paddle sport that hadn't before. You know, we think that translates into whether it be padel or tennis or other sports is only a net positive to squash because we're all interrelated.
Yeah, that's right. Now we benefit from that. People coming into our game, wanting a little, you know, wanting more community, wanting a different kind of workout. And so that's right. People are like, oh, pickleball. I'm like, no, don't worry about pickleball. It's good for us.
Absolutely. Pickleball, padel, which, you know, I think will grow to a certain degree. And the other thing that I think is important for people to recognize, you know, we talk a lot about youth sports, and youth sports is critical to any sport and the health and the future health of any sport, which is why we focus on it. And clearly, people are involved in junior squash for different reasons. Right now, though, as of, you know, 5 or 7 years ago, the majority of kids involved in the sport are actually involved at the scholastic level, as opposed to sort of, you know, the sort of traditional junior tournament level. But our most passionate players and the vast majority of our players are people who have come to the game sort of during college or after college, who then continue to improve for 10, 20, and 30 years.
Yep.
And so that's really the interesting part of it, where you might see some top college squash players who are in their 40s or 50s move on to...
Like us.
Yes. if they have free time, which I don't seem to have much of, but in their free time, move on to sports like padel, because they can continue to improve in that, and it's fun and new.
Right.
There are a ton of people coming into squash in the same way.
That's right.
And so I think people shouldn't look at that trend as a discouraging one, is to say, look, squash actually retains a lot of its college players, both in singles and in doubles, but there are a ton of new people coming into the sport, and, and the districts do a great job of operating leagues, very robust leagues all around the country. So that's sort of the silent you know, giant of the sport that doesn't get a lot of airtime, but is really robust, and I think that's part of what we want to tap into, as you know, those players say, hey, I want opportunities for my kids to be able to play, and that will help grow and develop the sport, and you know, many of these people are successful or influencers or can move the needle locally in their communities, and that's what we're going to rely on.
I mean, we always say that the majority of people aren't strong players. You know, it's not sort of the very high level, as we used to call them. And the majority of people are also people who've come into the game later in life. They weren't playing, you know, eight days a week when they were 9 years old, right? These are adults who've come in, and that's increasingly the case in America, is because our game is getting more and more accessible, there are more and more of those people that, you know, maybe not be great players in somebody's definition, but are so passionate about the game. They've fallen in love with it as an adult. And, you know, you see that at tournaments, and you see that at league, and sort of on the average night at an average club, there are a lot of people out there who just love the game, and it's one of their core communities is the squash community.
No doubt about it. I'm really optimistic for the growth of sport over the next couple of decades, you know, for those reasons.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, like, you've played a central role in pulling off two incredible feats, the Spectra Center and getting into the Olympics. So you've had a good little run last couple of years with some of these goals that you've had. I mean, you and I talked 20 years ago about, oh, it'd be great to have a national headquarters, a place we can train and, you know, build some courts. And now we have this incredible facility that's, you know, performing so well. And of course, everybody always talks about the Olympics, like, you know, why are we not in the Olympics? And you've got to feel pretty good about getting to this landing spot.
The sport's incredibly diversified, if you look at it as sort of a portfolio, you know, across, you know, all sorts of types of facilities and types of players, geographically expanded out west. You know, we're hosting the Junior World Championships in Houston.
Right.
So California and Texas are huge states and are areas of growth, expanding pretty robustly in the Southeast. And, you know, we need to focus on the Midwest. However, to have a home for the sport here at Spectra Center, critically important for the organization, just a really stabilizing force.
Yeah.
We are in the process of building out our high-performance team, sort of the team behind the team, to make that just a huge core competency of what we do,
yeah,
you know, for 28, for 32, 36, and beyond. and being in the Olympic Games and just having that wind in our sails now is what is going to be helpful. It's not the difference maker, but it's very helpful in terms of really driving more exponential growth in the sport moving forward. So I think everything's in place to be successful. We need the community support in general because we are still small. We need to get bigger so that we can become more commercially viable. But we're getting there, and I'm very optimistic.
You interact with the USOPC, and has conversations kind of changed in the last 6 months? Like, because of we're now in the Olympics, like, are internally, or are we getting a different vibe from you know, the other people you work with?
Well, pretty soon after it was announced that we were included, we had the Pan American Games, and we had our most successful, you know, Pan American performance ever. And Gene Sykes, who's the chair of the USOPC, you know, met with the team afterwards, and he even spoke to the caliber of the athletes, and that squash was now included in the following month's conference call among all the other governing bodies. So it's really nice to get sort of a tip of the hat from the leadership there. We're already, and have been for a long time, well integrated into the USOPC.
Yeah.
It being April 2024, everybody's focused on Paris and delivering a great games there, and the USA performing. And then, you know, it's been made pretty clear that the shift then occurs for the next quad. And so,
you
know, we've a lot of respect for the USOPC and that relationship, and you know, they'll be great partners leading up to it for sure, as well as the LA organizing committee. And, you know, we continue through World Squash and PSA engaging with them to make sure that it's a great hosting of the sport.
So you've had a lot of mentors over your 20 years. You know, you've worked with a lot of great staff and a lot of great board members and a lot of people out there in the game, district association leaders and people running various programs. I mean, you've really, you know, you've interacted, emailed and texted and met with, you know, thousands of people. How has that sort of, you know, changed you, or what, you know, you look the same, but like maybe a couple of gray hairs, but, you know, how has the community changed your, you know, your thinking about things or your approach? You know, you've had some really great people. We just lost Alan Fox, former president, chair of the board. Lenny Bernheimer, some great mentors. But you know, how do you think about the community in that way?
Well, to your point, I think a fair amount of focus ends up being on the national governing body and what is U.S. Squash doing about X or about Y, and or why isn't U.S. Squash doing A or B, which is natural and makes a lot of sense. The analogy is, if you're a fan of a baseball team, you're going to be questioning, you know, the general manager and the ownership in terms of why aren't they making these trades or that trades or et cetera. But, you know, people who are into squash, you know, are vested in that, and they look to us to a degree. And my point of bringing that up is, you know, those are thousands of people. There are thousands of people who work on in squash full time every day. And ultimately, those are the ones who are making it happen. So, I think, you know, what we do is important. It's central. It's the middle of sort of a bunch of concentric circles that sort of spread out and echo out across the entire country. And because we're America, the entire world. And so the extent that we've been able to sort of not be a black box in terms of how we operate and what we do, and have people understand it and how we can work together, I think that's been the key to being able to progress things, whether that's with the PSA Tour and parity, whether that's with the College Squash Association and bringing men's and women's together, whether that's stimulating growth at the middle and high school level. whether that's collaborating around technology and how that can help people, you know, advance what they're doing. So I guess it's sort of like, well, it's a huge community, and there are a lot of people working really hard and have worked hard, including the hundreds of coaches and teaching pros who are working very hard to support the sport. It's hard to be a teaching professional in squash. It's a lot of work, and people are innovating in all sorts of areas. And then the other point on the other side of things is that, you know, one or two people can make a huge difference.
Game's still small.
You look at what John Fry did in terms of welcoming the U.S. Open to Drexel, then ultimately, you know, brokering, you know, a really long-term deal that has put the sport on a footing we never had before, or Melinda Justy, who we honored, who 20 years ago said, hey, I'm going to make this happen, this national championships happen. And efforts like that happen from time to time, and I would just say that increasingly, you know, Arnie Dratt in Chicago saying, I'm going to make this happen from an outdoor squash perspective. And, you know, we will stand on his shoulders sort of making that more broadly available. So, you know, a person or two can make a big difference. We can amplify it and support it. We need to do what we do with integrity and competently, professionally, and with a very open mind. I used to say, you know, squash is small, and we need to leverage that to our benefit. I think that now we can say squash is unified as a sport.
Yeah.
Let's use that as sort of a competitive advantage to help grow the sport into sort of the more mainstream, which I think everyone would want and expect of the sport now.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the next phase of things. And again, if we're speaking in a different way now, it's not because of the Olympics, but that sure helps us achieve these higher order goals now. So, you know, it takes the whole membership, it takes the whole community to make these things happen. And that's sort of more and more what we're going to try and message and actually implement.
Right. How much has your game deteriorated in the last 20 years?
Well, that was going to be my first answer to your question, is that it sort of has taken my my hobby and my off time outlet away from me a little bit. It's hard to go to any squash facility and just sort of
play.
You like to lose yourself in your game and both between the fact that it's just been, you know, a really full on job and then raising a family, you know, it's not unlike many people. I think it's fallen by the wayside. So it's been hard to keep consistency. The high water mark for me was 2018 and competing in the World Championships down at MacArthur Center at UVA. That was wonderful, and so I want to get back to that. I'm an optimist, so I think I'll get there. But it's going to take some work.
I thought you were going to say that winning the Mel Russ.
Multiple-time winner of the Harvard Russ Invitational. I'm eternally grateful for Richard Chin including me in that. And there's another example of someone who, you know, one person can make a huge difference. And you know, he's moving the needle on that front. Karen Arango on the women's side. Steve Scharf on the doubles. So you just, everywhere you turn, people are digging deep to advance the sport, and that's what it takes.
Yeah. Now it is a small sport, and I think everybody loves that people know each other. But I think a lot of us, we love meeting somebody new who's also passionate about it, somebody we haven't heard of or we haven't met, and we get to know them, and then, you know, that rippling effect keeps going out.
And I think, and I can conclude with this, and I think part of the reason for that and what I like to sort of open, sort of middle and close with now is the idea of shared values in the sport. The sportsmanship and character traits inherent in being able to play fairly are built into the sport, and that's fairly unique in that the fair outcome depends on each player. behaving with integrity, honestly, with respect and courtesy, and being personally accountable, calling their balls down,
right.
Offering a let,
right.
Offering a stroke. Those things are central to the sport. And so as the community grows and diversifies and spreads across the country, I think those shared values are what people actually connect on. Mm. Every sport has its culture. And I think for us, ours is a lot more rooted in those values. Mm. Other activities have other unifying themes. So, for example, if you're an actor and a performing artist and you're in a show, there are certain practices that enable collaboration and require creativity and require an openness and a way of communicating. So, you know, there are other activities have other ways of bringing and bonding those communities.
That's
effectively.
Right.
And I think sportsmanship and character and the values that gird those characteristics are sort of what brings the community together.
Yeah.
And I think we'll continue to as the sport grows as long as we do our jobs well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point.
Outside the Glass would like to thank our producer, Grant Irving, and all our loyal listeners who have reviewed and rated the podcast, shared their enthusiasm for it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and more importantly, has spread the word by talking about Outside the Glass with their squash friends. And may all your Knicks roll.